Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Pivot Point, as you know, is a profile of an extraordinary business leader in South Africa, where we like to have a candid chat about their journey to where they are and their motivations for where they are. And in particular, what might have they have done had they not succeeded so well at what they're currently doing? Tonight's guest is Mteto Nyati, currently the chairperson of Eskom Holdings, executive chairman of BSG, a homegrown consulting and tech company specializing in strategy execution. Previously, he was group chief executive of Altron and CEO of MTN South Africa, author of the number one bestseller, Betting on a Darkie, that I just finished recently and revived a great deal of hope, inspiration, and energy in me to continue what we're doing here in South Africa. His book actually focuses on his life as a shopkeeper's son, a family man, a business leader at local and multinational corporates. He mentors and coaches senior executives, including CEOs and up-and-coming business professionals. In 21, the University of Johannesburg's College of Business and Education honored Mteto with an honorary doctorate in IT management. He is, by training, a mechanical engineer, and he is in studio with me. Mteto, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, Refilo, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this engagement.
Yeah. So am I. I have to give the backstory of the reason we crossed paths, which was a wonderful dinner that was hosted in Cape Town with a number of up and coming business leaders and small business leaders. In that engagement, you gave us a bit of this path that we'll discuss this evening in terms of your journey at a time that was not long after the election. And GNU negotiation, and where we were a little bit on tenterhooks as to what to expect. It was also at a time that Eskom at that point was already acknowledging almost 150 days of no load shedding. And as I said to you at that dinner, yeah, but we don't really trust you. How did you do that? And it, you know, Eskom's sort of the trust deficit with the public was at a place, and you restored that massively for me. So I just want to say, on a personal basis, it was important that we share those insights more broadly.
No, that's great. I'm looking forward to the NK because many people still do not believe us.
I know. And we're almost at 170 days.
We can never be tired of explaining this because people need to, they need to trust us again. Of course, we need to earn that trust, and we are trying to earn the trust.
Okay. So let's kick off where many South Africans were in June. And especially after some of the machinations of GNU and some of the back and forth in negotiations at various metros, what is your sentiment about where we are in South Africa and the path ahead?
Yeah, look, it is for me, when I look ahead, I think we're in a good space right now. Of course, we cannot be celebrating and saying that we have won. No, but we've got the right kind of foundation. If you think about energy is key to everything. So having a secure energy supply is the first thing. That's one. Then when you have all of the political players, the key ones, agreeing that this is the path that we need to take, and we need to suspend the narrow party interest and put South Africa at the top, that is another big tick for me, And then you see, recently that whole group, most of them, they went to China.
Yes.
And some who
used to criticize China.
People used to talk about all sorts of things, and now they are all there, and they are again representing our country as one South Africa. That again for me is a tick, because I was worried about the foreign policy piece, given some of the challenges that at an individual party levels, but they never came through. They put South Africa first. So when I look at all of this, I say we are moving in the right direction. When I look at the fact that many state-owned enterprises are reaching out to us in Eskom and say, guys, can you help us understand what is it that you did? That's a good thing. People are keen to learn and also turn things around, you know, whether it's in Transnet, whether in CETA, and that's a good thing. You know, people are, they want to change things. They want to set this country on a positive trajectory. All of that is good for me.
My struggle with you is that you're very humble, but do you think you would bring us into your confidence as to what you did thus far? That you might be able to, you and the team at Eskom, that you might to be able to attribute to some of the successes in the short term?
Yeah, so we'll look at Eskom. At the end of the day, when you analyze what was the problem there, for me, the problem starts at a leadership level. You know, leadership not just at the top, leadership at many levels within the organization. And so when we came into the organization, we were appointed by the president and also by the late Pravin Gordhan almost 2 years ago, you know, in October 2022. And we decided as a team that one of the things we're going to do as a board, we're not going to be a board that just sit there, meet once a quarter, and we have, you know,
coffees.
And then we leave. No, we decided we're going to roll up our sleeves, going to try and understand deeply what is the problem within Eskom. That meant engaging with staff. That meant us going into the different power stations, you know, sitting and trying to understand. And we came to the conclusion that, you know, I think the problem was defined in a wrong way.
Yes.
People were saying we've got an aging fleet. You guys in the newspapers, in the media and everywhere, you are writing aging fleet. Yes. That's the problem. When in reality, and the answer to that aging fleet is, okay, let's retire the aging fleet.
Right.
And allow the private sector to invest in the renewables.
Yes.
So that was the answer. When we looked at this thing deeper, actually the problem was around the unreliability of the fleet. And the answer to that is, go back to basics, maintain the bloody fleet. That's it, you know. Just go and maintain that.
Yes.
But the question is, okay, how do you do it in such a way that when it comes back, it comes back in a better condition? Do you have the skills? Yes, we had, but not all of the skills. So what we then required was to go and think of, can we work with the original equipment manufacturers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as like, for example, if you own a Toyota,
yes,
you don't go and take your car to a back room mechanic, a chop shop somewhere. Mm. There, you go and take it to a Toyota dealer. You know, that's the kind of relationship we needed to reestablish our relationship with the original equipment manufacturers, and we did that. And the next thing is, do we have the right funds? Can we spend money to do this maintenance? We didn't. So go to National Treasury, get this debt relief that helped us to be able to do the maintenance that we needed to do. As you take out the equipment refiller away, you're actually creating a problem for the country, because that's capacity that was
correct,
producing electricity, and now you are removing it. So you are ending up with load shedding. So we had that first year huge amount of load shedding, and to minimize that we had to burn a lot of diesel, 30 billion rand of diesel. But it was a, you know, a short term pain, because we could see a gain ahead. Where we are now, we're seeing the results of the work that was done that whole year of last year.
So, so two things around the leadership. The first being the importance of sort of, as you're doing now, taking us into your confidence.
Yeah.
I don't think when that short-term pain was happening, South Africans at large had a sense that it was deliberate and with an outcome in mind.
Yes.
It was short-term extreme pain.
Yes.
You know, level six, stage six, if I recall.
Yes.
It wasn't just the inability to operate. It was affecting, I was on a different radio station at the time, it was affecting small business owners' mental health.
Mm.
People unable to schedule shifts. You know, so it could there have been a bit more communication, or were we still sort of flying a little blind within the executive? Is it easier for you to say this in retrospect, in other words?
Look, what was happening is that at the time when we were about to start with the Generation Recovery Plan, in fact, 2 months before that, our CEO resigned, right? So that's the fact. And the CEO is the person who's supposed to be the one who represents the company, the face of the company. So the question is, who should do that? Should that be the chairman? Mm-hmm. Should it? So no, I'm actually, at the time, I was not the chairman. I only became the chairman in October. Yeah. So when you look at that, and then sort of, so that the fact that we really did not have a permanent CEO of the company was the problem. We could have handled it differently.
Okay.
Yeah. So we could have handled it differently. Yes. The other thing is that our president at that time appointed Dr. Ramahoba.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
So the two streams of accountability.
Yes. Then we felt that instead of, because we had agreed with the president that we need to have one voice, not too many voices.
Yes.
So we then allowed and we fed a lot of information to Dr. Ramahoba, who represented us very well.
Okay.
But I think some people also wanted to hear directly from ESCOM, although he did a fantastic job.
Yes.
But there is this inherent thing, people do not necessarily trust
politicians,
so they wanted to hear from them. But he is somebody that helped us a lot during that period when we did not have a CEO.
Okay, that's fair. The other point I wanted to make, actually you mentioned his name just now because you're taking me in a different direction, so I'll change the pace for 2 seconds. For a few moments. If you're just joining us, it's 12 minutes past 7. The voice that you're hearing is that of Mteto Nyati. He is the chairman of Eskom Holdings, and I like to say turnaround titan of South Africa, helping us understand his views on leadership. This is Pivot Point. We're talking also about his journey to where he is, which we will come to shortly. Leadership is a massive theme in your life. And you touched on the late former minister Pravin Gordhan and his impact from a leadership perspective. And I have to say, in the trust deficit that I was experiencing when we first met, you enlightened me about the key role that he played. I don't know if you wanted to talk a bit about that, because especially in light of some conflicting commentary on his legacy as a leader of public enterprises.
Yes. I mean, when we got into, we appointed as members of this new board in October 2022, and I clearly at the time was talking stage five, stage six, stage five, almost on a daily basis. And what we then started to hear from the minister saying, each time we're moving to stage five or six, can we have a board meeting?
Yes.
So we started to have board meetings each and every, like every day we're having a board meeting. And we, as a board, said, no, we need to manage this. We cannot have this board meeting. What are they going to solve? We need to have the space for us to go and understand this. Then we can start to have, but right now these board meetings are going to lead to nowhere.
Yes,
So we gave him that feedback that can you just give us the space for us to go and he listened. That's the first thing. People say that he doesn't. He listened, and indeed we went there. We did our work. We came back with our work. We then said it's going to take 2 years. And of course, he was not impressed with the 2 year turnaround.
Who could be?
What is it that you guys do not understand about your job?
Right, it's urgent. It's an emergency.
This thing you're supposed to do, it is like 2 months. Sorry, sir.
It's going to take
2 years.
Yeah.
Again, okay.
Listen.
I get it. Okay, can you work with me? Help me. Well, go with me to go and deliver this news to my boss. Here is somebody working with him, giving us the space for us to be able to communicate directly, So all of this, to me, I'm just trying to show that this is somebody that if you come back with a logical way of thinking, trying to explain evidence-based thing, he listens.
Okay.
And he changes his mind.
Okay.
Then the next thing, we realize that, hey, we've got a huge problem here. Our employees, the morale is so low.
Yes.
5 years without salary increase. And we're expecting them to turn this place around. So also at some point a previous minister of finance had removed this thing called bonuses, or we call it short-term incentives. Mm-hmm. And these are tools that we use to drive behavior. Mm. Very important things. If you want to drive behavior in a particular direction, you put short-term incentives.
Right.
And they had been removed. So we go back to him again, say, hey, we need to sort this thing out. People need salary increases. People need to have a short-term and long-term incentives, so that we need to have, instead of a contractor who is a CFO, we need to have a CFO who's permanent. Mm. All of these are structural things that talks to the, it's like policy of government that needs to be changed.
Yes.
Even now, how to determine the salaries of the executives, all of that power used to sit with the department.
Mm.
We said, no, that should sit with the board.
Yes.
You know, these are big decisions.
Those are huge.
Yeah. Then we come to the appointment of the CEO. Usually that needs to just go, you give them the three names,
yes,
and it's up to them to make the decision. We said, no.
Absolutely not.
We want to be part of this decision.
Correct.
And he allowed us. So when you look at these things and start to realize that this is someone, you know, who first he trusted this board, he gave us this space, he listened to us, and he supported us. You know, where we are now, you know, when you look at the, each one of the power stations are competing with one another, we are no longer driving things at the top. People are, it's self-driven. It's largely because of some of these incentives that we have.
And so what you're describing is a shift in corporate culture.
Yes.
Actually, yes. Which can take half a decade, decades to shift at times. And there were a number of things that were impacting Eskom. In addition to the financial remuneration that you describe, the burden of turning a country and a national utility around.
Mm.
The third thing, of course, graft had taken hold,
yes,
a lack of meritocracy,
yes,
the sidelining of some of the best of our engineers. I think there's a prevailing view that when we speak about the skills mismatch,
yeah,
that it's because all the white ones were left out. But actually, there were really brilliant young black ones that had been sidelined by people who had more nefarious,
yes,
intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Just talk to me about how critical it was for you, because this was one of the first answers you gave at Danan. It just blew me away. Part of your going into power stations was being able to recognize the people who knew what to do, but because they knew too well what to do, were shoved aside,
yes,
in favor of those who were trying to cook the books.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about addressing that, and of course, you know, the use of AI and the like.
Yeah. So one of the things that we picked up, okay, they were acting. There was so much acting this and acting that everywhere within the company. That is not good. You need to have people that are in those jobs permanently and not in acting, because decisions don't get made because people are uncomfortable. They are in,
yes,
acting positions.
And don't feel ownership.
Yeah, no ownership.
Mm.
So we pressed as the board that we need to have, in key roles, let's make a permanent appointment. One of those roles where there was an acting is the head of generation.
Mm.
This is the place, that's where all of the power stations report all the way up to,
yes,
the head of generation, and that person was acting.
Yeah.
So we need to have, and then beginning to have discussions, we start to, okay, there is this particular gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
But he had been moved aside.
Yes.
We don't think that he will take the job, but go and talk to him, you know. But anyway, long story short, this person's name is Beck Nxumalo.
Yes.
You know, if someone, if I look at what has happened in generation at Eskom, the turnaround, this is the person at a practical level.
Now, yeah. This is a really great live story, mm-hmm, to bring to us. Now, before I run out of time with you, because I could, yeah, speak to you all the way until 8, actually, if I could, but it's 20 minutes past 7. Right after the break, I'd like to delve a little bit more into this question of culture and how it showed up in various parts of your career,
mm-hmm,
and the root of it at that shop that belonged to your mum as a young man. It's 20 past 7, Teto Nyati, chairman of Eskom SOC. And I suppose a very accountable perspective of the man. Sure, there are editors and stuff, but I think you even leave in things where there might be moments of awkwardness.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the first thing, the accountability part of it. And it was reflected in what you described as sort of your early days in senior leadership at MTN, the accountability of allowing a town hall kind of meeting and allowing employees the opportunity to question you.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about how that cultural shift was accepted at MTN.
Look, people, you know, we've got all of these environments where when they look up, they are scared, yes. You know, and they start to call, I was called sir, you know, and that already created a problem for me because immediately someone is using that word, is creating a distance between yourself and them.
Right.
Right. And already the things that you will hear from that person is probably going to limit what he or she is going to share with you. Mm-hmm. So I decided, let me continue to be out there. Please mm-hmm. don't call me sir. Call me Mteto, you know,
yes.
and that one thing just alone, you know, it changes the dynamics of the environment.
All the way through to the gentleman who brought you tea.
Eh?
All the way through to the gentleman who
yes,
brought you tea.
Yes,
he
yes,
also
yes.
makes a contribution in the book, yes.
Yes, and then I remember there was this moment, because one of the things that I chose to do is that on a monthly basis, with the whole of MTN South Africa would account back to them.
Yes.
This is our long-term plan. For this year, this is where we want to go. And this month, how have we done against that?
Mm.
You know, continuing to give that feedback and then allow the employees to ask questions, you know, and they could ask anything. And I remember one of them, the guy said to me, we've just made an appointment of a white CIO, Chief Information Officer.
Yes.
And he said to me, sir, immediately saying, sir, you know that you shouldn't be calling me sir, but that's why I didn't say that. Sir, so he's raising me up there and is likely going to be trying to pull me down hard. Said, I am very, very disappointed in you.
Mm.
How can you, as a black CEO, your first appointment, the person you appoint here is a white person?
Mm.
So the reason why I'm sharing this and saying I'm sharing it because if it was in another environment, this person would have kept quiet.
Correct.
I would never have known that this is how he or she is thinking, right? And here, openly, this it says a lot about that culture, a culture where people are feeling safe
yes.
to hold their leaders accountable.
Correct.
And that is what is required. We are too respectful. As
Agreed.
A result, we end up allowing wrong things to happen, you know.
Almost like that South Korean issue that's raised in what's that economics book? I've forgotten the name now, where they look at the dynamics where South Korean pilots, the deputy
yes.
pilot never say you're flying
yes.
into a crash.
Yes.
They'll say, oh, isn't that cloud a little bit close? And then we crash
yes.
because they're too scared of breaching seniority.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You want the people closest to the ground.
Yes.
The people who closest to the ground, people closest to the customer.
Yes.
These are people who understand what's going on there. 100%. They need to tell us, they say, hey, you are telling us to go this direction. That's the wrong direction because this what I'm hearing on the ground is this.
It's so interesting. I do think South Africa has an epidemic of managing up instead of managing out to the client. Because if we're doing what the client wants, boss will be happy, right?
Mm.
One of your bosses, the late Sifiso Dabengwa, was one of the contributors to betting on a darkie.
Yes.
I opened my broadcasting here at the beginning of September with a tribute to him. I knew him as first Uncle Ray, my dad's friend, and then as Sifiso, my colleague, taking him around New York when he became group CEO on the road shows.
Yes.
And I know him to be a man of few words and limited compliments.
Yes.
And his contribution to your book moved me deeply. It was before he passed, mostly because it was guarded, but highly respecting and complimentary in Sifiso's way. Would you like to say anything about him today? I wish Kaya listeners and the general public knew more about him.
Look, this is the man that was there are a couple of things about Sifiso. First of all, when it comes to his integrity, you know? When he says something, he does exactly what he said, you know? So that's one big thing. And I think me and him, we connect around that piece. The other thing is someone that felt that there is no one group in this world that has got a monopoly for excellence.
Absolutely.
What I mean here is that somehow excellence is generally associated with white.
Yes, or male.
Or male, exactly. And he felt that no, that is not the case. And I am meaning he is going to demonstrate that that is not the case through how he led and the kind of people that he appointed. I remember some of the people that were in his funeral. You know, these are the CEOs that he had appointed, female CEOs, appointing them here, appointing them there, gave them the opportunity to lead. That is Fiso.
Absolutely.
You know? And those people, they never failed him, you know. That thing of spotting talent, you don't have to be perfect before he makes the point. He takes a risk on you.
Correct.
Right? How many leaders do that? In your absence.
Yeah. Yes.
In his quiet way, in your absence, he would say positive things about you. That's what you want. Generally, most people say bad things about you in your absence. What he was doing, exactly the opposite. You know, that is the man, you know, when it comes to excellence, comes to integrity, you know, really, really supporting other human beings to develop and giving them opportunity. That's all that human beings want, to be given opportunity.
That is my experience of him as well. So this now allows me to take the thread to your very first job. Around recognizing excellence, regardless of the packaging it comes in. Yeah. Another contributor to your book, you'll forgive me for forgetting her name, but the other engineer that was brought into the grad program with you, the two of you were the two who did not look like the usual excellent engineer. She, a white woman,
Ruth,
you a black Ruth.
Ruth Stenhouse, yeah.
That's right. And he and you a black man.
Yes.
Also loved her contribution. And you both turned out to be excellent and successful engineers and business people in your own right. It's something that you've carried into your culture in every organization in which you were, that you, in which you work. And I love that you don't shy away in the book from recognizing some of the biases that we know about culture, race and the like, or even gender, and recognizing it and using that as a tool to engender trust.
Yeah.
What can we learn in this time where there remains a resistance? We know what has to happen in terms of either economic empowerment or inclusion. There's a global fight against diversity, equity, and inclusion. And yet, white men will not win in this country alone, and black women and men will not win in this country alone, and women won't make it without the support of men. What's some of your guiding, maybe, principles that you might leave us with from a leadership perspective before I ask you my second last question?
So what I would say is that many of us, we are not self-aware. Meaning, we have not paused and say, what is it that Refilwe is good at? Yes. What is it that is not so good at? Because once you do that exercise, then that already gives you a sense of the kind of team that you need to put around you. It must be some people that complement you. You know, as a man, I've got certain way of looking at things, certain perspective, but we are serving a market that is diverse. So if I put around me all men, we are going to have a problem in terms of serving this market, for example. The same with you know, on the race side of things, you know. If you want to serve certain, you know, I want to serve Soweto, you know, and all I have around me is are all white men, you know, we're going to have a problem around that. You know?
Yeah.
So for me, the diversity angle, but starting from you understanding who you are. For example, I'm an introvert. Think about it now. We have got this exco of all introverts, you know, executive committee of introverts. The thing that we are good at is listening.
But you're a communications firm. You mean now at ESCOM?
No. I'm just saying.
In any place.
Okay. Here is this ESCOM full of people that are good at listening.
Who will talk?
Who's going to be talking? You know, who's going to be challenging who in this thing? Yes. So you need that diversity.
Absolutely.
Right? So I would say that this is something that comes, does not come naturally.
No.
So you have to consciously do something that is against what comes naturally. We generally like people who are like us.
Yes.
You have to consciously go and look for people who are different from you, people who can challenge you. That is probably the single most difficult thing for leaders to do.
I'm so frustrated. I'm already over time, but two things I want to mention, and maybe I can't hand them over to you as questions. The first being, you started out having to understand what you are selling with a diverse customer base in your mum's store in the Transkei,
yes.
And that has served you well in the way you approach diverse people.
Yes, yes.
And the second that I really loved about your book and that I love about your approach is you're one of the few CEOs that I've seen that actually shows, first of all, you're very well read and very well learned, whether it's just-in-time inventories from Japan, and you apply, you never see people applying their reading and their learning directly in examples, whether it was at Microsoft or at MTN. And I want to just thank you for that and remind people that the theory exists for a reason.
Yes.
Can we go back to basics, as you said about ESCOM?
Yes.
Please continue with what you're doing.
Thank you.
And I hope this is just the first of many opportunities to chat.
Of course, it will be. Yeah, I have no doubt we'll come back here.
Indeed, I look forward to it.
Yes,
Mteto Nyati is the chairman of ESCOM and also chair of BSG, a homegrown consulting and tech company that specializes in strategy execution. And you no doubt know exactly why after that conversation.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.